Vivaldi, violins, venison virgins. All coming up next, it's Rosemary Manchester with Barbara Quick live in the studio. It's a novel idea.
Anno Domini, 1709. Dearest Mother, since I was first taught to dip a quill and pen my ABCs, I have imagined writing to you. I have written many such letters in my mind, and you have read them. They made you weep. With the power of exquisite music exquisitely performed, they called you back to this place to claim me. Have I ever been in your thoughts as you have been in mine? Would my eyes remind you of the infant I was when you last saw me? When I happen on my reflection in a dark window, I am sometimes startled to see a young woman's face looking back at me. How much more surprised would you be to see the transformation wrought by time? Here, within these walls where you left me, I have grown like those plants that are cultivated indoors, with shallow roots and always turning toward whatever sunshine can be stolen from the day outside. I have heard that children often resemble their parents. I have looked at my long-fingered hands and wondered, are they like your hands? Is my profile like yours? Do you have fair hair that seems not to belong with your dark eyes? Is there also a hunger inside them? Until this morning, I had no hope that any letter of mine could ever reach you, nor any assurance beyond the promptings of my own imagination that you even lived. Today, all of that has changed. Who you are, where you are. Both are as much matters of darkness to me as before, but I pray to the Holy Virgin even though I have never seen her. I play my violin for God, even though I cannot know if he has ever listened. Why can I not then write to you? Sister Laura has never, as far as I know, lied to me before, and today Sister Laura told me to write to you. But I must explain. On this one day a year, the filii di coro, the daughters of the choir, as both the singers and instrumentalists are called, are allowed to visit whatever blood relations on the outside are willing to welcome them. Girls look forward to it, plan for it, dream about it, and then spend the rest of the year hoarding every detail of it like squirrels with their treasure of nuts until the next year's visit comes around. Last year, on this day, while servants beat rugs and shook out draperies, I sat beneath the arch of my favorite window near the rooms occupied by the privilegiate of the coro. The window affords a splendid view through the iron grating of all the life that moves upon the water in Venezia below us. I sat on the little bench there in the silvery storm of dust that danced in the light, my arms wrapped around my violin. I heard and then watched Maestro Vivaldi climb the stairs. He has been my teacher and one of the very few men who has ever seen my face or spoken to me for nearly half my lifetime. I was only a girl of 8 when newly ordained as a priest, Antonio Vivaldi, native son of Venezia, was hired by the governors of the Pietà to be our master of the violin. I can remember the day when Sister Laura brought me before him. Don Antonio sat in the sacristy, unwigged, his hair as red as the branding irons they use to mark the infants when they're left here. Just like the one that marks me on my foot. A small, ornate letter P to designate a foundling enrolled at the Pietà.
"What's this?" Don Antonio asked. Looking up from the papers and quills that lay in disorder on his writing desk, he protested that he was hired to teach the advanced students, not the piccoli.
Sister Laura pushed me forward, even though with all my heart I longed to turn and run away. The color of his hair frightened me. It put me in mind of the flames of hell, and the impatience in his voice bespoke a man who had no love of children. But Sister Laura urged him to hear me play.
Good evening and welcome to A Novel Idea. This is Rosemary Manchester, your host. You've been listening to Barbara Quick reading from her book, Vivaldi's Virgins. Barbara, I'm delighted to have you with me in the studio tonight.
Thank you, Rosemary. I'm really delighted to be here myself.
Yes. The book is published by HarperCollins. It first came out in 2007 in hardback and is now available in paperback at your favorite independent bookstore. Is the book on tape yet?
No, I really would love to read the whole book on tape because I read it a great deal in readings at other events and I really enjoy it.
Whenever you do it, it must be you who reads it because you read so beautifully.
Thank you.
So I thought of the book as the book of four V's, Vivaldi, violins, Venice, and virgins.
That's good. I like that.
And what a wonderful mix. Mm. You think, how can all this come together in one book? And of course, there's a wonderful mystery hidden in the book, and there is no way that we are going to reveal the solution to that mystery. The reader will find that out for herself as she makes her way through this book. But you can see from the opening lines that you read that we're listening to a young girl pining, yearning for the mother that she never knew. Now, the circumstances become clear as we get into the book. Do you want to tell us a little bit about how Anna Maria is where she is?
Yes, she's in one of 18th century Venice's four grand ospedali, which are literally big hospitals. Venice at that time had a great social welfare system, a great social safety net, and they took care of their indigent and poor. In this case, the Ospedale della Pietà was for illegitimate children, or children who were simply a great inconvenience to their parents, perhaps the child of a courtesan and a senator, or the child of a priest, or the child of a woman who had not had conjugal relations with her husband for many, many years and found herself in the embarrassing position of bearing a child. So these children were brought to a special place in the wall of the Church of the Pietà. It was called the scaffetta. It was a kind of revolving drawer which opened from the outside and from the inside of the church. So whatever desperate mother or her agent brought the baby, you know, wrapped up to the scaffetta, they would ring the bell and put the child in the drawer and then scurry off into the night. Well, Anna Maria, the Anna Maria I write about was truly a foundling of the Ospedale della Pietà, a real girl.
She was a real person.
A real person, and there are records of her. It's very cryptic, but they are there. Each child, there was an intake done on each baby. The clothes were described in great detail. Some of the babies arrived wrapped in filthy rags. Others were wrapped in cloth that was very precious and indicated that they had, you know, wealthy or noble parents or both. And sometimes the child might be gripping something, half of something always in a little fist or have something around their neck. And mothers who hoped to be able to come back the next year or the next decade or in 2 decades to reclaim their child would keep the other half of whatever it was so that they could prove that this was their baby. So all this information was recorded in the Libri della Scaffetta, and it was secret. It was kept under lock and key because these children were dying to know who their parents were, and they also had a great reason to know, which I'll explain later.
Yes. And then there's a wonderful incident in the book in which Anna Maria, as an older child or young woman, is witness to the arrival of a baby at the Escafeta. And then, of course, from that we flash back to what her arrival must have been like. And I thought that was a particularly poignant scene. Yeah. I want to ask you about Vivaldi, who is a very important character and, of course, a real person. I know something about classical music, but all that came to me when I got Vivaldi was, of course, the Four Seasons. If the man were alive today, he would be so sick of hearing us play over and over again the Four Seasons.
Except he'd love to have the residuals.
Oh,
from the...
he did.
He was always struggling terribly for money.
Today he'd be rich and famous.
He would, alas.
Yeah. But you have written a great deal. You've discovered a lot of his music. I understand that much of his music is still being discovered.
Yes. Well, I can't take personal credit for discovering any of his music, although I thought once when I had lied my way into one of the archives of Venice, at first they didn't let me in when I said, you know, sono una scrittrice americana, I'm an American novelist, and they weren't very impressed with that at all. And then I came back the next day wearing glasses, and I told them that I was a PhD musicologist, and then they let me in. So that was the fastest PhD anyone has ever received. But I was there looking through various papers they had, and actually I was able to page the part book of Anna Maria, which is the book in which all the solos that were written for her were gathered together by her, and with her notes and Vivaldi's notes in their own handwriting. And the thing that made me cry and try to hide it was that where she or he had made a change, she took another piece of lined music paper and put the proper notes on them. And then since there was no whiteout in those days, she sewed it on top of the musical lines so that it replaced the old music. So it was, I really felt such a almost a tactile sense of connection with her in that moment.
Yeah. But to look at any original score is such a thrill. It's transporting.
It was. And I loved it. Vivaldi, in one of his marginal notes, wrote, più veloce che possibile. Faster than possible.
You have a great knowledge of music. Are you a musician yourself?
I play the fountain pan.
Very good.
I wish I were. I mean, actually, right now, in a very timid and humble way, I'm studying the viola with my fiancé, who's a violist with the San Francisco Symphony. Mm. And I feel that deep inside me there is a musician manqué, but I took some piano as a kid and I sang, and I have a pretty good ear for music.
Yes. And a tremendous appreciation for it. You have obviously a great feel for it. It really comes through in your writing. I mean, you're not just writing about notes, you're writing about music.
Well, you know, it was interesting for me because Vivaldi, for whatever reason, left very little behind in the way of personal writings. There was almost nothing. There are a couple of dozen letters, but they're all formal letters to people he's hoping will become patrons or people he's angry at, you know, about not giving him enough money or cheating him, various things. But there are no diaries. There's not even a painting of that we know is actually of him. And it's as if somebody destroyed that trail. But I was a bit in despair because I thought, well, how do I create this character who was, is a well-known historical figure, but I can't just make him up.
Right.
I need to find the traces of his spirit and his mind and his heart and his motivations. And then I realized, wait, he left a record. He left all this music. You know, how many thousands and thousands of pieces of music. So what I did was I just started reading scores, looking at his notes in the margins and just listening to the music itself. Because, you know, it's another kind of writing, but someone expresses themselves as much in music as a writer does in words. And so I realized that he was this extremely ambitious composer. Artist, much more artist than priest, and yet with a great spiritual depth, that he was narcissistic, that he was probably a fabulous teacher because he needed incredibly good performances from these orphan musicians they were the only way he had of having his music heard. And he cared about that more than anything in the world. Of course, yes. There were no recording devices, so it was the file di coro or nothing. So I imagine he made them play till their fingers bled. And they loved him, as we always love the teachers who get the absolute best out of us.
That's right. The most difficult work that we do is the one that we love the most. Right. Yeah, and you mentioned somewhere that you listened to his music constantly as you were writing, so that it just infused your writing.
I did. Mm-hmm. I did. My last research trip to Venice, I was fortunate enough to be able to rent this amazing flat on Giudecca Island across the basin, the Bacino, from Santa Maria della Salute, this fantastic church. It was so beautiful in every light, and I just pulled a big armchair up to the window and I put my headphones over my head and I listened to music that Vivaldi wrote while he was in residence at the Ospedale della Pietà. And I cried when I wrote the sad parts, and I gabbled to myself as I wrote the dialogue, because I always like to read out loud what I write. I'm sure I sound like a complete madwoman, but I had a great old time doing that.
After his death, he practically disappeared. His music wasn't played for
200 years.
Yeah.
Well, what happened first was that he got in a lot of trouble with the clergy.
Yes.
He was traveling with some young women, and I have some speculations about these relationships in the book, which I won't divulge. But he was always breaking the rules. He was in it for the living, as so many people were in this time. I mean, the calling of priest or nun was a way to make sure you were fed and housed. And he was following his passion, which was music. Mm-hmm. So that meant that he often crossed over the lines of what it was considered proper for a priest to do. And so there was such scandal attached to his name that he was, in effect, exiled from Venice, which he adored Venice. He was a native son of Venice. And he went to Vienna, and it was very sad because his big patron there, the man he thought was going to be his big patron, died while Vivaldi was en route. So he got there, no patron, no money, no gigs.
Nothing.
And basically died in poverty and utter obscurity. Mm-hmm. And for almost 200 years, you know, it's really funny. If you go to any history book about music written before 1960, you'll see if there's any mention of Antonio Vivaldi, it's either as an eccentric priest or violinist. No one talks about him as a composer. It was only in the 1960s when some music scholars...
Really?
Yes.
That recently?
Yes. Some scholars decided that Johann Sebastian Bach had actually been greatly influenced by Vivaldi. And so people started looking at Vivaldi's music. And then as the years went on, new troves, the treasure troves of this music kept showing up in various places. They were buried, you know, and there was just a new flute concerto that was just found in the last 2 months.
Oh, that's so exciting.
It really is amazing.
It's wonderful.
So he went from this utter obscurity to, I mean, you know, the Four Seasons is the most frequently heard classical music anywhere.
That's right.
Yeah. Although I think the Four Seasons are great, and it's enough to strike terror in the heart of any violinist.
Really?
Oh, yeah. Oh, it's so hard.
Oh, it's virtuoso. I didn't realize that.
Oh, absolutely. He wrote music that only he could play sometimes. and Anna Maria was one of the very few others who could also play it.
Right.
So they had a very special relationship.
Yes. Oh, I must commend you on your website. Your website is wonderful. As soon as I arrived on your website, it began to play Vivaldi right out of my computer. I thought, oh, this is glorious.
It's good.
You mentioned that when you were in the museum in Venice, the tiny museum, that the old stringed instruments were there. Mm-hmm. What are they like?
The bows have a different shape than modern-day bows, and they were playing catgut.
Mm-hmm. But do the violins look like violins?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, they do. I mean, the instruments might have been larger. Mm-hmm. Some of them might have been larger or smaller. Mm-hmm. Well, you know, the viola da gamba is what is now called the cello. It's the leg violin.
Yes.
And viola da braccia is the viola, and the violino is the violin. Yes. But I think they had instruments of all sizes because really they started these children very young.
They're very young. And I noticed, too, that they're little boys in the Ospedale, is that how it was? Mm-hmm. But it didn't seem that, I didn't read about any of them being involved in music. They were apprenticed out when they were very young, but not to music.
Yes, the coro of the Ospedale della Pietà was all female.
Yes.
So the boys stayed and were taught a trade until the age of 10, and then they were apprenticed out. In other cities in Italy, it was only boys who got to sing and play. In Venice, it was the girls. Mm-hmm. I don't know why that decision was made, but it was fortunate for little Anna Maria.
As I read the book, I wondered what the original impulse was. Was it Venice? Was it Vivaldi? Was it violins? Was it virgins? I mean, any one of those things could have impelled you into this story. But, you know, the combination is wonderful. Where did the book come from? Tell the story of that picture.
Okay, it's a funny story.
wonderful story.
Many, many years ago, over 20 years ago, I was in Budapest, Hungary, researching another book. I was just walking through a street market, and I saw an artist had some work out, including an engraving entitled Vivaldi. And it showed a young composer with a quill sitting at an 18th century keyboard of some sort, surrounded by what I took to be his muses, angels.
And that picture's on your website.
Yes, it's on my website.
People can go to the website and see
it. And it's in the paperback, too. Mm-hmm. And I bought it. It just spoke to me. Mm-hmm. I loved it. I thought, oh, how lovely, the composer and his perhaps this is what the imaginary angels playing his music as he's writing it. Well, the picture traveled with me. I had it beautifully framed, which was odd because I was really living on a shoestring. And I was living on a sailboat at the time, a 30-foot sailboat. So the only pictures I could have on my walls were postcard-size reproductions. So I put Vivaldi in storage, and he sort of went in and out of storage. Mm-hmm. I really liked the picture a lot. Mm-hmm. And then when I was finally able to buy a house of my own, I had already started looking into something I had heard, which was that one of the Italian composers whose name started with a V, I thought it was Verdi, I wasn't sure who it was, had also been a priest who taught in an all-girls orphanage. I thought, wow, what a great setting for a novel, but surely someone has done it.
Right.
So I went to the library and I looked into it. Nobody had done it. In fact, there were only scholarly books on Vivaldi. So I got them out and I read them all. And I started conceiving of the story made of letters written by this orphan named – I named her Pellegrina. Her birth date, I said, at a certain year. And I decided, oh, she'll be Vivaldi's favorite violinist and he'll dedicate many solos to her. And – then I actually got to Venice to begin my research and found a lot more material, including the archives of the Ospedale della Pietà. Mm. Lo and behold, there was a real violinist who was one of Vivaldi's favorites, to whom he dedicated 28 solos, who was born within 2 years of the girl I had made up. And I said, Pellegrina, sorry, Anna Maria is taking over. So Anna Maria, the real girl, became the girl that I had made up, which was really interesting for me.
So it started with Vivaldi then, rather than Venice. Yeah,
I guess that's true. Yes. But during that same time when I was in Venice, I made a trip to Switzerland and France and went through Venice to return to Budapest. I had a little stopover in Venice, my first time there. And I had a very moving experience being told by an utter stranger, sort of a street person, that I had better go to the ghetto of Venice.
Really?
Out of nowhere, you must go to the ghetto. So I thought I'd better go, and I went and had the tour they give of the three synagogues in the ghetto. And it was very moving and beautiful. And when I was out there by the well and they were describing how everybody got their water here, and I just started crying, and it was happy tears. And I thought, well, I always knew I was Italian. I'd always wanted to learn Italian. I started after that. I started studying it and it was in my mouth already. It was really funny. Mm-hmm. So I don't know. I mean, you know, I don't want to get too woo-woo about it, but I do feel that I had some sort of genetic connection to Venice.
It was meant to be.
It was meant to be. Right. And not only that, I made Anna Maria's chief rival for first violin a girl. Well, she became Bernardina for various reasons, but at first she was called Chiara. And she was blind in one eye. Yeah. And then when I went further in the archives, I found out that the girl who succeeded Anna Maria as first violinist was named Chiaretta, and she was blind at the time of her death. So it was a real Twilight Zone moment. And all along, it was like this. I felt that, you know, if I got quiet enough, I could sort of hear the past.
And you said at one place the story wrote itself. You don't do yourself justice. The story may have told itself to you, but I know how much work goes into putting that kind of sentences together. You know, putting flesh on the bones of your story, which you did so beautifully.
Well, thank you. I think it must be like, I've never written music, but I think it must be a little bit like writing music because, well, I started out writing poetry, and that's where I always return to that, to the sound and the texture and the taste of each syllable. I want it to be just right. And there is a right word. There is a right sentence. So it's just sort of I listen. And I think I do a lot of my writing internally so that when I actually write it down, it's more or less done. I write in notebooks with a fountain pen. And there are several important scenes in the book that if you look at the finished text and you look at my notebook page, it's almost word for word the same. It was kind of neat. I was happy.
You self-edit when you're composing in your head.
Yes.
What you're doing is arranging your sentences and getting all your words in order. And then by the time you get them on the paper, they're just the way you want them.
No, and as a result, I do a lot of weeding and planting of things in the garden and folding of clothes while I'm doing my writing.
Of course. But I think there's something about writing on paper with a fountain pen that produces a certain elegance in the writing that writing on a computer might not do.
I think there is a big difference. There's something about the tactile sense of, you know, the pen on the page, the ink on the page. Mm-hmm. It's very satisfying. I always sit in a particular chair that I have that I really like. And and I use this particular pen that I bought in Paris many years ago. It's completely beat up. If I go to a cafe sometimes to write, I used to do that when I lived in Berkeley. If I couldn't find my pen, I'd sort of have this panic attack, which I'd try to hide, you know, as I search through my purse or briefcase for the pen. I can't write without that pen.
I've never been to Venice, but just the idea of it is so powerful. No wonder this story took place in Venice with the carnival and the disguises and the mask and the living that's going on behind
the pageantry. Yes. The secrecy.
The gondolas, the palaces, the islands,
it's
the whole thing.
It's a magical place. It really is. And the marvelous thing about Venice is it's so easy to imagine centuries past when you're there because it's intact. I mean, the only difference is that the Vaporettos have, you know, motors now and there are electric lights. But because the automobile never came, transportation is still all by foot or by water. It's very much as it was.
And the Ospedale is still there.
Yes. Well, the church is a newer church, you know, built later in the 18th century. But the orphanage itself, the Ospedale della Pietà, parts of it are still there intact, and the water entrance. And it was very thrilling to see that. Though you can see on my website the well where the girls drew the water and also had recreation outside. Because they were incarcerated. They were cloistered within stone walls.
And when writers set the scene in Venice, they always somehow bring in the reflection of the sunlight on the water as it appears on the walls and the ceiling. And it's just so exotic to think of that.
It is. This watery city, it's very wonderful. And I would recommend never going there in the summertime. You know, go there in the winter or in the late fall. It was sort of a Disneyland before there was Disneyland. The people who actually live there and work there are a bit jaded.
Yes.
They're sick of the tourists. I mean, that's why for me, as doing my research there, I found it very hard to penetrate Venice.
That's what I've heard.
And I was very lonely there.
Yes.
I really you know, I no one asked me to have so much as a cup of coffee in Venice. I would, every time I went to Venice, I would bring some beautiful gown and, you know, a wrap and some really nice shoes. And I thought that I would watch the people going by on the, you know, on the beautiful boats to the various parties and the palazzi along the canal. And I thought, oh, I'll get invited to one of these parties, you know, and I'll have the clothes for it. Every time I brought these things and then was never invited anywhere. And I just thought, okay, it's a closed society. Yes, a closed here. Society. But then when I went to Bologna to do the research for my subsequent novel, A Golden Web, every door opened to me. Oh, they were so wonderful to me because Bologna has hardly any tourists. It's an equally magical and beautiful city. Well, it doesn't have the water, but it's a very fascinating city. And at the hotel where I was staying, they would introduce me as, oh, this is Barbara Quick. She is our writer, you know. And the librarians opened their arms and came up with theories and helped me with everything. And everyone was wonderful.
Yeah. And we will talk about Golden Web because you've written that since you wrote Vivaldi's Virgins, right?
Oh, I like talking about both these books. Oh. I'm fine.
Okay. We're going to take a short break. You're listening to A Novel Idea. This is Rosemary Manchester, your host. I'm talking with Barbara Quick about her book Vivaldi's Virgins. And when we come back, we're going to also talk about her latest book, A Golden Web. We'll be right back. We're back. This is A Novel Idea. This is Rosemary Manchester, your host, and I'm talking with Barbara Quick, whose books are Vivaldi's Virgins and A Golden Web. I wanted to talk about your characters. They're such interesting people because of their eccentricities and their passions and their faults and their virtues. The nuns in the Ospedale, particularly the prioress, is very important in the book because she holds the secrets. And I saw her as an absolute. In some of the nuns, there was a little give to them. They were this way and that way. But the prioress had the responsibility. And at some point, you described the young women as being indentured servants of the city of Venice, required to take this training and perform the music. I mean, they owed that to the city. And, of course, the prioress was the one who held the secrets.
Yes.
And must keep those secrets absolutely fast.
Yeah, she had a very big responsibility. I mean, the coro of the Ospedale was really the fundraising arm of the institution. It was a huge institution. It had not only these instrumentalists and musicians, but it was like a great industrial complex, you know, in and of itself. There were people learning all sorts of trades. They had their own basic, you know, factories, you know, for making sails, washing silk, a pharmaceutical industry, all sorts of things. And they were training people. you know, besides the children who were musically mm-hmm. gifted. And yes, the prioress was something like the CEO,
mm-hmm.
and she really mm-hmm. had to keep it all going.
Yes.
And probably like a CEO, she had special mm-hmm. privileges.
Yeah, and an extremely able administrator, the way she held it all together.
Yeah. I like that. The prioress has never gotten much attention in interviews. I like that character, too.
Uh-huh.
Because you could see, you know, she wanted mm-hmm. to tell more than she was able to.
Yes. And you mentioned going to the ghetto. Your character, Rebecca.
I'm going to play her in the movie, by the way. Or at least I want to read for the role.
Good. She was a little different. I mean, she was within the Ospedale, but she was not one of the religious. And she played, you know, a key role in the story.
Yes.
And I was so happy that you brought her into the story.
You know, the character of Rebecca, who is a seamstress from
yes.
the Jewish ghetto, who has the contract to make the choir robes for the girls and women of the coro. I really love that character, and it's partly because I based her on my maternal great-grandmother, who was a seamstress in Russia, who had the unusual job for a Jewish seamstress of making the hats and coats for the parochial schoolgirls. So because she had this connection to the church, every time there was going to be a pogrom, the priest would send somebody to warn my great-grandmother so that, and she took all her children and they were able to shelter in the attic of the church while the pogrom raged on the streets below, which would, you know, I always thought of the survivor guilt of that. That must have been a very strange position to be in. So I sort of made Rebecca the Venetian equivalent.
I found that the letters that you composed for Anna Maria to write were a wonderful way of exposing her thoughts and her inner life. And it was just about the only way that that could have been done. Did that just come naturally to you to say, oh, the letters, or did it start from the letters, or how did that work for you in the process of writing?
The whole concept for the book began with the idea of the letters of this girl writing from the foundling home to a mother whose existence she wasn't even sure of.
Yes.
But just writing.
Mm-hmm. And hope. She just poured out her heart.
A friend of mine whose mother is Portuguese used the word, I can only say it in Brazilian Portuguese, is saudade, to describe Ana Maria's longing. It's a wonderful word.
It is.
And that's what the letters are full of, longing.
Yes.
And I heard them. I felt, I got very quiet. I could hear mm-hmm. Ana Maria's voice.
You could hear her voice.
Yeah.
Because her voice is so strong. And the voice that carries you through the entire book.
It was interesting for me, Rosemary, because the book is written from two temporal places. One is Ana Maria when she's 14
yes.
and 15 years old, writing these anguished, hopeful letters mm-hmm. to her mother. And these are interspersed with narrative passages written by an older Ana Maria, who's mm-hmm. 41,
yes.
looking back. And of course, she knows how her story ends, but mm-hmm. she's not really letting the reader, you know
yes.
until the end. But she's describing the action from that place of perspective. And it creates a sort of innocence and an experience dialogue within
yes.
the book itself.
Yeah, and you did that seamlessly. You know, sometimes when I'm in a book that goes back and forth in time, I'm scratching my head thinking, now, is it then or is it now? But I you never lost me in this book.
I have to admit, I did work hard on that.
I could
because
see you
I
did.
Had to, you know, mm-hmm. I really had to make sure that you knew. If you just picked up the book,
right.
you knew.
You knew how important it was for the reader to be right with Ana Maria through the entire story.
And it was funny because I don't like outlines. I don't like doing outlines.
No.
They put me to sleep. But with this book, I wrote a progressive outline as I was writing the book because I had to keep track of what
yes.
the reader knew and what the reader didn't know as
yes.
I went on
That's
in
right.
the two time frames.
That's
so
right.
it was the most mathematical thing mm-hmm. I've ever done in my life.
Yeah, and the voice grew as she grew. I mean, at first it was in the parts where she was a very young girl, it was the voice of a very young girl. And then as she matured, so did the letters.
Well, that's wonderful.
Yeah.
That's wonderful to
well,
know.
It is wonderful. I mean, not everyone can do that. Not everyone takes the trouble to do that when they're when they're writing a book.
Well, my son, who's now 18, was 14 when I was working on the book. And I really drew on my experience with him a lot. And also looking back at myself when I was an anguished 14-year-old, remembering that, really remembering what it feels like.
So painful. I know. One wants to just have it over with.
That's right.
Right. I wanted to ask you, too, about the cover of the book. It's so beautiful. And, of course, the cover is on the website so that people can go to your website and see Vivaldi's Virgins. And many of the things we talked about are pictured there. But I was reminded by something you said that the author doesn't design the cover of the book.
Right. You know, people always imagine that the author has great agency. But, you know, the author is actually just a pawn, if that.
Yes.
And the only thing I was able to do was veto the original cover image because it showed this very beautiful girl in a painting by Rotari. The painting was called Girl with a Pearl Earring, and the book has been compared to Girl with a Pearl Earring.
Yes,
and I told my editor, look, this just isn't going to fly. We can't have that. And plus, ornamentation of any kind was strictly forbidden at the Pietà. So they said, oh, but we love her face. So they photoshopped the earring off of the picture. And I felt terrible for poor Signor Rotari who made the painting.
But it works.
It works. It works. And she does have such a sweet face. You know, on my bookshelf at home in my bedroom, I've got all the copies of the translations that I have so far. About eight of them have not yet been sent to me, but about eight of them are there. No, seven are there. And all the different covers are wonderful. And it's so cute because for all the different countries, Anna Maria on the cover is made to look like a person. You know, so for the Korean one, she's Asian. And the Hebrew version, she looks Jewish. And it's just this is a wonderful thing.
She's a universal character.
I've had the most marvelous letters from people all over the world about this book.
I saw some of the letters that were printed on the website. But on the cover, there's a wonderful picture of old Venice. And the color is so beautiful. And then at the bottom, music. And you said that you were delighted in the music they did. Let's put music.
Yes, absolutely. It was an ad agency that did the cover. They did a beautiful job. They have Anna Maria's face. Well, no, it's not Anna Maria. It's this girl with a pearl earring whose earring has been removed surgically. And then there's this beautiful canal scene by Canaletto, who was the great landscape painter of Venice, greatly collected by people, tourists who went to Venice. And then beneath there are two lines of music, and just by coincidence, it's from L'Estro Armonico, which is one of Vivaldi's pieces that he wrote for the girls of the coro. I mean, when I kind of looked into it, I was so thrilled. I thought, oh, that's too wonderful. Yeah. So you see his actual handwriting.
Would you read for us another passage from the book?
I'd love to.
Well, Vivaldi's Virgins.
I'm going to read a passage I've never read in public or on the air before because I want to give your listeners something new. Anna Maria has gone to Lido Island, which is still the place which houses the Jewish cemetery of Venice. And she's gone with her great friend Silvio, who's from the Jewish ghetto. The Lido hove into view, an unprepossessing shoreline of sand and scrubby trees, and so long that it was hard to think of it as an island at all. Silvio gave the gondolier a handful of coins, telling him that we would be a while. We walked for a long time between sand dunes, and then along a wooded pathway, and finally through a gate. The white Istrian stone of the monuments was even whiter for the moonlight washing over them. The headstones leaned every which way, as if the dead were gossiping with those they loved in life and pulling away from those they loathed. Some pairs of headstones leaned against each other, melted together in death into one. The older stones were grown over with trees and vines and half covered with brambles. Walking among them, I felt the spirits of the past hovering round me. Time has a very poor memory. We each of us do what we can to be remembered, but most of us are forgotten. If someone had asked me that night on the Lido who, among all those I'd ever met, I thought would live on in some way, I would have been hard-pressed to name more than half a dozen. Vivaldi, surely. My uncle, Marco Foscarini, if he lives long enough to become Doge. Gasparini and Handel. Scarlatti and the only female among them, Rosalba Carriera. The various popes and royal personages. Time always saves a place for these in her guest book. But what of the rest of us? I knew that each one of those blocks of stone in the graveyard stood for a life that was lived. Within each grave, beneath them, reposed and rotted, the mortal remains of someone like myself, who yearned, who wept, and laughed, and loved. Not one of them ever believed that what they strived so hard to achieve or avoid, the person they held most dear, their fondest dream, the secret they kept, the one thing that inspired their devotion, all of it would be as forgotten as surely as yesterday's rain. The legends on the tombstones are eventually worn away as the stone is eroded by rain and wind and centuries. Better to slip away quietly after having lived as fully as one can, doing the very best one can with the gifts one has been given. What more can a mere musician possibly hope for? Music cannot be kept or captured. It unfurls in one miraculous moment in time, and then it's gone. As Silvio and I walked through the Hebrew cemetery of San Niccolo di Lido, the sand worked its way into my shoes so that I knew I would carry a small part of these graves back with me to the cloister. It is tonic to be reminded once in a while that we are but specks in the world and as easily swept away.
Thank you. That was beautiful.
Thank you.
That was Barbara Quick reading a passage from her book, Vivaldi's Virgins. Since you published Vivaldi's Virgins, you have a new book.
Yes, A Golden Web.
The Golden Web, yes. And I've asked Suzanne Lang, the producer of the show, to talk with you about The Golden Web because she has more familiarity with the book than I do, and I try never to talk about a book with which I'm not familiar. So, Suzanne?
Thanks, Rosemary. Also, I want to note that the cover of your latest book, A Golden Web, is as beautiful as the one for Vivaldi's Virgins, a mesmerizing portrait of who I imagine is the main character, Alessandra.
I have something on my blog, asktherwriter.com, about the girl who posed for the cover. It's absolutely amazing. She's this gorgeous girl. They've made it look like a, you know, a Renaissance painting. I got this letter from this girl with a Russian last name in Canada who wrote to me and said, I was the model who modeled for the cover of your book, A Golden Web, and I just read it, and I'm so amazed because, like Alessandra Giuliani, I'm a pre-med student. Like Alessandra, I have an older brother and a younger sister, and my relationship with them is very much like Alessandra's with her brother and sister. And like Alessandra, I also love drawing and painting and the natural world. And in short, I was so inspired by this book. And I was so amazed. So there's a lovely picture of her, you know, in her civilian clothes, holding the cover of the book in her hand. It's just fantastic.
Amazing, amazing. Well, I hope you'll give us a little reading from the book, but the book seemed to open with Alessandra virtually performing the Heimlich maneuver, and in a way it's a strong setting for her intelligence and her spunk, in a way, and her interest in the vitality and the mystery of the human body.
Yeah, we should say that this book takes place in the 14th century, so it's really a long, long time ago in the world of, in and around medieval Bologna. The world of the Middle Ages was Oh, it was such fun to research because everything was alive. There were people believed that there were spirits everywhere, angels and devils, and there were great superstitions and a great passion for living. Life usually lasted a very short time, but people lived it very intensely. So it was a very colorful and musical and exciting world. And it was such fun to learn about it and write a story that took place there.
And like Vivaldi's Virgin, this character also lost her mother and is a woman, a girl, doing something a little different and a little against the grain. And in fact, it seems she said something, half the trick of being a smart girl is learning how to hide it.
Unfortunately, I think that's still true for some girls, which is amazing to think of, having to hide it if they're too smart. But in Alessandra's day, if you showed evidence of being too smart, you might be murdered, as one of her nannies tried to do to her when she was just an infant, convinced that this highly intelligent infant was a changeling. So, you know, she cast some oak galls in a, you know, beneath the cradle, and if they sank, she was, you know, a changeling, and if they floated, she wasn't. And she had the knife in her hand ready to kill this infant. And if Alessandra's mother hadn't come along and snatched her away, Alessandra would never have been. Of course, I imagined this episode, but I'm sure that for a girl at this time, I know it was very, very dangerous. Women healers were called witches, and witches were abhorred by and feared by the church, which ruled everything. So it was very dangerous to be too smart and to be female.
Now, this book is released by HarperCollins Children's Division, and it seems to be targeted to young adults, though it didn't read that way to me, that it was just targeted to that audience. But did you, when you began the book, have a different point of view, or were you looking to widen your audience a little bit?
Actually, that there was just a particular editor I wanted to work with, and she happened to work in the children's division, Rosemary Brosman. She's really wonderful, and we've since become friends. So I was going to write it as a young adult novel. I was told by some editors there that they really were looking for historical teen novels. But I really believe that a good book is a good book, and I don't write down to any audience. I mean, this is, as far as I'm concerned, anyone who loved Vivaldi's Virgins could love this book as well. It's, you know, packaged, I guess, a bit more with the teen reader in mind. And my editor asked me to, you know, to sort of create a little more to make the romance a bigger part of the story. But, you know, an adult editor might have done the same thing. And Alessandra Giuliani, who is the heroine of this book, is reputed to be the Western world's first female anatomist, who studied with Mondino de Lucci at the University of Bologna, which was the oldest university in the Western world. But whatever I could find on her says that she actually did her work at the university dressed as a boy so that she wouldn't be killed. And so the story is about how she manages to disguise herself and her nanny, who she has in tow, as men. And they go off sort of like Don Quixote and Sancho Panza, riding off to the towered city of Bologna. And she is simply in search of knowledge, a girl who has lost her mother in childbirth and who believes that somehow this didn't have to happen. There must be another way. So she's fascinated by human anatomy and by the natural world, and she's always processing the world in that way. Well, what makes these things work this way?
Well, do you feel like reading from the book a little bit?
I would love to.
Give our listeners a taste of A Golden Web.
This is from chapter 7. Alessandra has just announced to her father that she intends to go to Bologna and study medicine. Carlo looked at his daughter a long time before responding to the astonishing thing she'd just said. He knew that she was not like any other child, male or female, he'd ever known, but this newest conceit of hers left him quite speechless. She spoke when he said nothing. There are female scholars in the town.
Are there?
Carlo looked thoughtful. Are you sure? Alessandra was longing to say yes, of course she was sure, but in truth, she didn't know. Now that she thought about it, the few female scholars she'd ever read about had all been high-ranking nuns from noble families, or noble women who were tutored at home. Females, I believe, can attend lectures if they so desire. At least, I've never heard any injunction against it. Her voice trailed off into uncertainty. And medicine, child? What man would surrender his pulse and his urine to a female physician? I want to study the workings of the body, Father, not to wear the red gloves and attend the ill. Will you learn only from books, then? Because I can and will procure whatever books you want, and you can study them here at your leisure. He gestured around the warm and cozy room, with its bed as commodious as a throne, well padded with embroidered pillows and hung about with curtains, now pulled back to let in the light. In the safety and tranquility of your own home. Alessandra looked around her room, taking in all her father had done to make it a whole world for her since her stepmother had clipped her wings, keeping her imprisoned there as surely as the finches in their wicker cage. I want to study as Aristotle says men should study. Men, Alessandra, not girls. It's true, the old Stagirite had nothing kind to say about the intellectual capacity of females, but Carlo held out his palm to keep her from saying more. You cannot go to Bologna to study medicine. You must not even think about it anymore. Carlo shook his head when she was silent, simply looking at him with those brown eyes of hers that were so like her mother's, filled now with reproach. Your stepmother will never allow it, and although I am ruler of this family, still it is in my interest to keep my wife in good humor, at my expense. How you vex me, Alessandra! What you're asking for is unreasonable. No girl of Persichetto has ever gone off to study in Bologna, and females are not permitted to compete for advanced degrees. You would heap shame upon our heads, and even Pierina's chances of marrying well would be compromised. It is not fair. It is the way of this world, daughter.
And yes, there is an evil stepmother in this story.
Very evil. I loved writing her.
Barbara, I hope our listeners get to hear you reading locally sometime soon.
Actually, I think that I'm going to arrange something at Copperfields sometime soon for a golden web. I think it would be really nice.
Great. Well, thanks for coming in today, Rosemary.
Mm-hmm. I so enjoyed listening to that reading. I'm going to read that book.
Oh, thank you. That's the best thing to hear.
It's been such a pleasure having you in the studio today, Barbara, to hear about The Golden Web and Vivaldi's Virgins, and to talk with you about your work, your inspiration, and the way that you've brought the stories together for our pleasure. We thank you so much for those years and years of work that went into this writing.
The pleasure was mine. Mm-hmm. I'm new to Sonoma County, and this is a wonderful welcome. Thank you so much, both of you.
It's wonderful to have you here.
Thank you.
Let me remind you of Barbara's books, Vivaldi's Virgins and A Golden Web, available, of course, at your local independent bookstore. Check out also Barbara's website, which is barbaraquick.com, for more information about her work. These books would make great gifts. Books are always wonderful gifts, and you can never have too many books. Suzanne, thanks for your help tonight.
It's always a pleasure to talk to an author like Barbara who enjoys her work so much, and I want to encourage our listeners to check those books out.
Yes, absolutely.
And we'll be back in the new year with conversations with more authors about more books, because you know what, Rosemary?
There's no such thing as too many books.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So happy holidays, Suzanne.
You too, Rosemary.